trickling streams find their way to the rivers, and they are rivers. Rivers run to the ocean, and they are ocean. Blessings fall upon you like soft rain from the lofty clouds, filling the holy grail of our hearts. As sunlight fills space. These moments together are timelessness. They are resonance, here and now. They are discovery of who you are, not who you become, but who you've always been. Welcome to Star Media Transmission, dedicated to the great mystery.
We have again the privilege to have an interview with Hannah Rachel Bell. I'm excited as I know that a lot of you wrote in and said how wonderful it actually was. We feel so too. I'm sorry about, and I want to apologize now for any interruption that may come through the line, but the interview was excellent itself. Hannah, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, how are you?
Hi. Yes, a lovely evening, a beautiful evening in Fremantle, Western Australia.
Nice. Yes. Also here in the Pyrenees, beautiful day.
Oh, that sounds beautiful. My only knowledge of the Pyrenees is watching Le Tour de France.
Yeah, I think they go by our house. I'm not sure, but I've always said they do.
Well, I watch it because I think the helicopter aerial shots of landscape is so beautiful, and there's the sense of literally flying over the landscape. It's just stunning.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful place. It's very mysterious here. It has a lot of grail legends. It has its own ancientness as well here. And I move from world to world from here, like the Grail stories, and in a very deep way, to Australia, to Peru, to meet the Caros and the Pacos. Very lucky life I have here. I love living in the Pyrenees. You're always invited.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Hannah, where we left off the last time was with Wangina. I don't even like to say the Wangina, because when you insert the, you put it a distance somehow, particularly a being so sacred and intimate. Would you like to continue with that, or do you have something that you would like to deliver on this interview particularly?
I'm happy to follow your, you know, your direction, your questioning. So if you wanted to start talking about Wangina, that's fine.
I would like to know if the Aboriginals ever speak about where Wangina came from. There's a lot of speculation about that.
Well, Wangina came from the sea, came from the ocean.
Okay.
The Indian Ocean. From the beyond the from the islands, and possibly from the islands off the northwest coast. What's interesting about that is that 12,000 years ago, those islands were in fact exposed, and sea levels rose and drowned the land between the islands and the coast, leaving channels, and I might say channels which have become humpback whale breeding sanctuary.
So
those islands are those archipelagos are where Wangina came from.
Do they speak of his origin in the sense of there's a lot of speculation about Wangina being a star being?
That's Wandjina as a star being is in as much as the Milky Way is the source of all life, and that includes the source of Wandjina and humans and all living. Well, it's more than living, it's animate and inanimate. Because you know, in Garanyan belief, everything is living, you know, including rocks and,
of course,
you know, everything is living. So they don't have this classification of, you know, rocks and, you know, things that are firmly fixed as being dead.
Right, me too.
Because nothing in creation is dead.
Exactly.
And in fact, the whole notion of dying and death is really about transitions rather than completions. So and that goes for Wandjina as well. You know, Wandjina appeared in the landscape, you know, somewhere around 8 to 10,000 years ago. Prior to Wandjina, there were other beings, the Guion Guion, and the Guion Guion appeared somewhere between 30 and 35,000 years ago. And the Guion Guion brought stone tool technology and the beginning of the Wunan Law. And the Wunan Law is the law in the land by which creation functions in a way that is sustainable for itself. So Wunan is really a relationship system. And you mentioned this star being. You know, the Milky Way reflects itself into the land.
Right.
And so is the source of life, and everything is alive. So from that perspective, but in terms of individual kind of spirit beings firing down from the heavens, that's not in their cosmology. It's more Wandjina. You see, Wandjina is the storm cloud, and
yes,
that's, you know, that's in the heavens. And as the storm cloud, Wandjina manifests himself, although he's not always he, manifests himself as Wandjina, as Agula, which is like Pan, a mischief spirit, as Jilinga, the earth goddess, the earth mother. They don't have goddesses either, the earth mother, and as Lightning Brothers. And Lightning Brothers carry water across the land. So Wandjina as cloud. And that's an interesting idea as well, because Wandjina is the cloud of unknowing.
Oh.
Which is really, really interesting. Wandjina, for the most part, is masculine energy. And what is often called two eyes, a nose, but no mouth. And the eyes have no pupils. You look into the eyes and you look into that which is not known and is unknowable.
That's really powerful. Can I ask a question here?
Yeah.
Thank you. Is Wandjina confined to Australia?
Yes. In fact, Wangina is in fact confined to quite a discrete area of which is the Kimberley. Wangina is the original or the first monotheistic religious or spiritual being. And Wangina walked the landscape, but didn't, for example, get down into the Pilbara, south of the Kimberley, and didn't get across into the Northern Territory, although Lightning Brothers did. Guiyong Guiyong, in various manifestations, appears in Arnhem Land, and I think in Cape York, and in the Kimberley, but Guiyong Guiyong doesn't exist very much south of the Kimberley. So there are these kind of geographic and geological relatedness of where Wangina is, but Wangina is really in a quite a discrete area of the Kimberley. Nobody knows why. And it's not a question that any Aboriginal people ask.
Yeah, that makes sense. They don't need to ask.
No.
No. So what is Wangina's function? How did they relate to Wangina and Wangina relate to the Wangina people?
Well, Wangina is rain and storms. And as cloud is the giver of rain, sacred water. And Wangina being the masculine energy, it's as though Wangina is emptying himself as a kind of a constant fertile, almost like an ejaculation into the earth. Now, why that is significant is because once the waters hit the earth and calm in the landscape, water holes, rivers, and shapes the land so that the landscape can take advantage, can absorb the life-giving, creative force of the rain that comes from Wangina and Wangina cloud. So when you look at the skyline in the Kimberley, you see Wangina massively on the horizon. You actually see the Wangina head and the great shafts of light coming out from Wangina. It takes up the whole horizon.
Beautiful.
During the rainy season. And then, of course, Wangina appears as Lightning Brothers, and this is like cloud cells, storm cells moving across the land, often in twos, and there are two Lightning Brothers, and they move through the landscape together. So when Wangina absolutely empties himself into the land, into the feminine, the water hole. That's where the spirit children that are reflected from the Milky Way into the water hole. And Shantimaya, you can see them. You can see these little flashes of light in the water holes of the Kimberley. It's the most spectacular thing to see. And you know that this is the spirit children that have come via Wangina from the Milky Way into the water holes.
It's beautiful.
So the water hole is Wungud water. Wungud water. Wungud is feminine. And what it underpins all of Ngarrinyan Warora Wanambul cosmology is this relationship, this sacred relationship between masculine and feminine. So that you have Wangina inseminator, Wungud conceiver. Yeah? It's
yeah.
like wungud water is the amniotic fluid of creation.
That's beautiful. I remember in your book that you spoke about wungud. Is that how you pronounce wungud?
Wungud, wungud. It's like WOOGOO, wungud.
Thank you. I remember in your book you spoke about it in one little spot. It really impressed me. It was where the mother was telling the child not to desire things, not to desire, because wungud has supplied everything. Everything is there. And you just explained that to me. That's really, really beautiful. So
it's almost like a trinity, and it's amazing how often this notion of trinity permeates culture. So you've got Wanjana, the masculine inseminatory power. You've got Wungud, the conceiving, conceptual power. And the third element is Wunan, W-U-N-A-N, Wunan, which is the relationship. That's the relationship system.
Is that? I'm sorry, I mispronounced that. Was that the word that you used? It seemed to me to be a matrix of everything that this mother was talking about to the child, and that.
Yes. Well, you see that what that refers to is that, you know, when the child is in the morning, most mornings, and the camp, you know, people wake up at Piccaninny daylight, the babies cry, and the mothers and the grandmothers actually pull the children out of their bedding and by the fire they smoke the children as the fire awakens and dawn arises, as the sun peeps up over the horizon, you know, the fiery light of day, the fire of the sustaining that sustains in warmth and food, and the fire of awareness, the flame of awareness is awakened in the child, and the child is put through a little daily ritual which is quite beautiful. And you might be thinking of that. That's called wudu, and it's pronounced W-O-O-D-O-O, wudu. And in this wudu, yes. Granny touches the child in the pubic area and says, you mustn't go sniffing around in other people's camps. Everything is provided for you in Wunan. And then it touches the mouth. You mustn't talk badly about other people, because everything is available to you in Wunan, and you don't need to speak badly about anyone. So there's this little ceremony, this little ritual that is awakened in the child to coincide with the reawakening of the fire from the coals and the birth of the sun coming up during the day. And that's wudu. So there you have Wanjana providing the water of life, Wungud being the sustainer of life, the creation. Wunan, the relationship system in which everything lives in relationship with everything. And Wudu, the awakening of awareness in children of the system, the cosmology that they're a part of.
So all of these qualities and powers and these life-sustaining mysteries, I would say, they're seamlessly integrated. I mean, it's like sapidity in water and water in the atmosphere and water in the clouds, and so it's everywhere. Each one of these qualities are integrated into the other quality seamlessly, it seems to me. Is that right?
It is. It's like fractal reproduction of the idea of itself manifesting itself through all, infusing everything with itself. And there's a really interesting thing about that. One night we were sitting around the campfire. It had been a beautiful day. The campfire was really roaring. We had about a dozen white fellas visiting us at our camp. And all of us had kind of coats on because we could feel the heavy air, like the moisture in the air creeping down our backs. And Paddy Niarda said, he said, everything is water. Yeah. We're nearly all water. Yes. Only reason we're not getting wet right now is because fire keeping water up high. When that fire died down, water, he come all the way down and settle on the land and on the Woongood water. Morning time, he said, you look. Look at that Woongood water. When sun come up, water go back up into the heaven.
That's so beautiful. That's so beautiful. Wow. It's do the Aboriginals, I wonder, do the Aboriginals see reincarnation as a viable transformation, universal transformation, like back into the tribe?
There is no, to my knowledge, there's no word for reincarnation, but it's an integral part. It refers back to what I said before, that there is no completion.
Right, so
we exist in a cycle of livingness, but in through various transitions. So when we, what we would call die, the spirit of the person whose body has been left behind, the spirit of the person returns to a place called Dullagun. And there it's a mucky root place where there's neither night nor day, and the sun doesn't shine, but it's a place of joy, a place of grace.
Wow.
So when a child is born, they're inspected to find what their Woongood mark is. Woongood mark is a totem, something that will demonstrate the spirit, what spirit they are born in. So how that translates is certainly the spirits of people who've passed away are born in newborn children. Certainly that happens. But so is the spirit of animal, of tree, of insect, of spider. And I remember this, one of my boys, Claude Muljali, had his shirt off, and he had this rather heavily raised scar in his side. I said, "Oh, Claude, what happened there?" He said, "That's where my daddy shot me." "Oh, Claude," I said, "what for?" He said, no, Anna, not this one. He shot me when I was an emu."
Wow.
Yeah. And so emu is his Woongood, and that's his Woongood mark. One of my other boys has got a really raised sort of scar tissue thing on his shoulder, and that's his Woongood. And it kept growing and growing and growing. And I said, "Lukey, do you want to go to the doctor and have that cut off?" He looked at me as if I'd suggested he have his leg amputated. He said, "I can't do that. That my Woongood."
Uh-huh.
And another, you know, and this is a really interesting one as well. Another one of the boys that I was educating in Perth, I took him into the shoe shop to get a pair of school shoes, and he put one on, and that fitted really nicely, and he put the other one on, and of course it didn't fit because he had what we would call a club foot. Okay. "Oh, Kane," I said, "what's wrong with your foot?" "Nothing," he said, "nothing wrong." And when I spoke to his dad, Paddy Nyora, "what happened to Kane, his foot?" And his dad said, "he right. He was emu before he was Kane." Mm-hmm. "And that's how he should be."
That's beautiful. That's beautiful.
He's perfect the way he is.
That's beautiful. Wow. So they see that you can take any life form, or do they see a kind of evolution, so to speak, of the spirit? Do you know?
I'm not aware that they see it as an evolving thing. It's not like the Hindu.
Yeah, or
reincarnation. Because they don't actually even see evolution. And the reason they don't see evolution is because they don't see time.
Right.
You have to have a concept of time to have an idea of evolution, you see. So, and because for them, time is, rather than a line of past, present and future, for them, everything exists in the dreaming, and the dreaming, everything exists contemporaneously.
Yes.
So there is no past. There is only a continuing present.
Right.
So that when you think about ancestors who've gone before, they haven't gone anywhere in time. They've simply transformed and are somewhere else in the map. So time and the dreaming is more like a metaphysical map.
Yeah, that makes sense. And in the Hindu way, again, although I'm not a Hindu, I was definitely learned a lot there. In the Hindu way, they're also tell the yogi you have to give up the past and the future because neither exist. And I always wondered, Hannah, who made the first watch that put that round thing on our wrist?
It's pretty funny, isn't it?
It's very strange indeed. And it's put us all in a kind of military formation. From morning till night, and this has to be, it's almost like how you were describing the room protocols, the kitchen, the living room, like that, you know, same kind, everything is categorized and contained, and we move from container to container rather than an open experience.
You know, modern civilization, and by modern I include every patriarchal civilization for millennia. All of them have depended on measurement, and measurement, of course, is applied to the entirety of existence. It's the basis of all science. So whether you're measuring the distance to the outer planets or beyond other Milky Ways, or whether you're measuring, you know, the rate of uptake of water in a tree or something at a nano level, our culture is obsessed, absolutely driven with measurement.
Yes.
And, of course,
yes.
Measurement and in terms of the notion of work in a capitalist society relates very strongly to productivity. How much work can you do in an hour and make a profit?
It comes right down to our soul in comparing with each other. And it is the way It's a digital kind of mapping, I think, don't you? Do you see what I'm talking about? This little square, this little square, this little square, this little square. This is high, this is low, this is right, this is wrong, this is better, this is worse, this is more beautiful, this is less beautiful, this is greater, this is this kind of thing. Is all contained in the person in that scientific measure as well as that. It's a control mechanism.
One of the greatest ironies is that the image of the Wandjina is the original binary code, because the Wandjina comprises what we call zero and one. Of course, it doesn't mean zero and one to Ngarinyan. The circle is the feminine, and the one is the stick or the masculine.
Right.
And they, those icons, if you hold your hand up and your left hand you make a zero and your right hand you make a one, there you've got binary code. But what you also have is womb and phallus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, this is the primary relationship. I said in the introduction to one of my books, whilst I write with my right hand, my left hand gives me balance and lift to live a two-handed life. That's the relationship between zero and one. Now, what is so interesting is that that code is the basis of our entire digital world. And when I was speaking to the lawmen about this, they thought this was pretty funny, because they say that this is their law. This is their law. This icon is their law, manifest in Wandjina. And zero and one is like a chiffon or big net pattern that's in like an aurora, that's constantly streaming and moving and dancing in life. And of course, that's when you look at digital code and you look at a program broken down into its digital code, Shanti, that's what you see, this most incredible dance of 00111001111, all dancing around each other. That's allowing you and I to have this conversation now.
I was thinking about this natural law and how it's totally over. It reaches through everything. It is everything. And if we don't care for it, if we don't listen to it, if we don't live by it, it seems to me if humanity goes away, the reason that but I'm going to go ahead with that word. Perhaps the reason that the Aboriginals say that their law is intact is because even if the natural world wipes humanity off the face of the earth, that law is not compromised. Would you say that's true?
And so Wungud self-corrects. You know, we had in Queensland a couple of after, you know, a decade of the most horrendous drought, and the Gold Coast, I think it was the Gold Coast, had only 15% of its water supply left. The inland, you know, the inland areas, inland from Queensland into the Northern Territory, hadn't had any rain for so long. The earth was cracked open. There were two rain events that absolutely swept in from the Coral Sea that drowned villages, that wrecked the foreshore of Brisbane, that cut away metres of coastline, that poured into the river systems, that filled the Cooper's Creek, which ran into the centre of Australia and created the most amazing inland sea that you could imagine. And within days, wildlife came from all over the world into rookeries and nests as the rains kept coming and coming and coming. People said, oh, thank goodness, the drought has broken. I said, I'm not sure that the drought has broken. I think what's happened is Woongood is looking after itself and has simply said, uh-oh, my land is thirsty. I must send enough rain to satiate the land, to fill all the artesian basins, to create rookeries and nestings for my wildlife. And if humans are so silly, they build perched on the edges of cliffs and below floodplains and in storm surge zones from the sea, well, too bad.
So taking care of itself, nature taking care of itself through its own laws, when one lives or many live like that, then the care is for... You are the nature. You are the law of nature. You're not apart from the law of nature. You're immersed and integrated and totally the law of nature. So you are cared for in that way. The moment that you back away and forget the laws of nature, you're still the laws of nature.
That's right.
It's so... yeah. And this is when you just... offered that incident, it showed that, yeah, you're still the laws of nature. You can't get away from it.
Time deniers are a mystery to me, but in one sense, you know, politically it makes me hopping mad, in another sense, I just smile in an Aboriginal way and say, Woongood looks after itself, because as you say, climate deniers, it doesn't really matter what they think. It doesn't change their reality. And their reality is that they are an integral part of nature, whether they care to honour that or not. And it just doesn't matter whether they do or they don't. And that's the interesting thing about, you know, the about Woongood and about the Ngarindin cosmology. Woongood is not a loving father. Woongood is not a loving mother either. Woongood is in a constant state of grace and self-correction and self-maintenance. So there is no morality in Woongood. So if Woongood wipes out, you know, the Brisbane coastal plains for the benefit of the land, that's what Woongood does.
Exactly. So if Woongood takes humanity off planet, like a dry chunk of land that's cracking, and replenishes with the rain, we have lost nothing really, except for our own integrity while we're here, and our own wisdom. Meaning the wisdom of the cosmos, and have died as ignorant and foolish part of nature. It's so how round and spiraling it is just incredibly, stunningly beautiful.
In fact, you know, one of the things I think Woongood does is purge itself of materialism and material culture. Mm-hmm. It knocks down edifices that we create, which we think are for forever or in perpetuity. And Woongood just doesn't have an opinion about that, except that if it's in the way, it'll get bowled over or burnt or cycloned out or tornadoed up or whatever. It's not punishing or anything like that. It just doesn't care that our material culture that we hold in such, you know, such sacred awe is so utterly vulnerable.
again, this little line going through the Kimberley from outer space, this tiny little silken thread that actually holds the power that people think they have over others. That was such a poetic and beautiful, beautiful example. And also the drought. I think morals, anyhow, whether we use that word or not, we create them. And when we live by the laws of nature, we don't have to talk about morals. And we're in our integrity, so we don't have to consider it so much. Sometimes I think, Hannah, that some spirituality can actually be quite narcissistic, unless it's totally entered and experienced. If we go over it again and again and again and again and don't integrate, we don't even have to integrate it. It's coming from within us. But if we don't actually live it, then what we're doing with our spirituality too is just needing again and again and again to be convinced of what is really true in us, and we know it's true, this natural law.
In my worship of my intellect, and I don't say that lightly.
No, I can imagine that you don't.
Because what they're telling me is that my intellect is only useful when I'm awake. When I'm asleep, my intellect is asleep. What is awake when I'm asleep is that my presence and participation in the dreaming. And the dreaming manifests itself in my dreams, in my imagination, in my memory, in my creativity, in my entire visual expression, which, according to Ngaranyan, is where truth lies. Intellect is liar part. That's what they tell me. Because it's completely in control of an ego. Dream, my right brain, my intuitive, my inner self, my subconscious, my memory, that entire well of my knowing, that's where my knowing is, right, as opposed to my knowledge. My knowing is in this pool of knowing. It's a pool of knowing into which I drop, and that's where there's the aurora of binary code. It's where the truth of my of the map, the timeless map of everything that has been and is. It's in this vast space of my truth. That's when I am in my dreaming. And when I'm in my dreaming, I'm in your dreaming as well. We are all in the dreaming.
Thank you. Can I ask you something about the dreaming? That was really beautiful. And you know, I don't mean to say that spiritual people are narcissistic. It's, to me, there has to be a point of acceptance that what you are seeking is within side of you and within your world, you know, and it not to be held apart from you, constantly being held apart from you. Is this what you also mean by ego? Is that the sense of being separate or isolated or different than others?
That's right. Separation.
Yeah.
Separation. The first way we separate from very young is with language, spoken language. The second way we separate is written language. And the third way we separate is through using, is measurement. And through those three, in particularly written languages and measurement, we reduce the world to that which is measurable and textural, as in word texts. And we've done that at the expense of true respect and honouring of our dream space, that part of us which is our visual narrative And of course, it's our visual narratives which make meaning of the world. We experience the world in our visual dream space when we're awake and asleep. And then we try to make sense of that by whipping it across the corpus callosum into our language units, where we then translate it into a communicable form, such as the one we're sharing now. However, as we're talking now, I don't know about you, but I have a sense that we are floating in a dream space, a watery dream space, where you and I, if we kept our mouths shut, especially me, we would still be deeply connected, as with anybody who listens to this.
Yes, I have a hard time with the word disconnected or connected, because in my view, in my experience, there's no such thing as connected or disconnected. It's impossible to separate. I see this whole, let's call it the dreaming, respectfully, as a seamless event happening in the moment. And yes, you know, Hannah, I have a theory that when our language started to have spaces between, like Sanskrit was sung, the old grandmothers, Aboriginal grandmothers, they sing the stories. This singing had a continuity of language that was unbroken. But when we started to put spaces between our words, that it started to, it was maybe a cracking or a fracturing of our deeper perception and ability to, what do I want to say? Sometimes I stop for a long time and wait till the word arises, to communicate in a seamless, again, kind of intuitive manner. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I think you're completely right in that. And the separation in language, excuse me, serves to separate us from everything, because it's the tool of separation. When we're singing, we're also gesturally moving, sometimes dancing. We may be painting up as well. We may be adorning. We may have instruments. What we're actually creating is a communicable dream, which is a sharing of our knowing. And it's not that I give something to you, it's that collectively we dance and sing this life together. And you will know from listening to Aboriginal singing, which we do every day, is that there's the song master, and then there's the chorus that comes in, and there's the sticks. And it's as though these three forms blend together in something which is arrhythmic. You know, it's quite unlike Western music, which is mathematical. Aboriginal music is spiraling around and around, as do the dancing and of course the painting, which creates its own energy and light.
Maybe we stop here, Hannah, and the next time that we come together, maybe we can speak about the dreaming and who's the dreamer and so like that. Or we can pick it up anywhere you would like to pick it up. Would that be okay with you to close now? Because I think that it's so rich. I think these interviews are so rich. They're a lot to digest, and people listen to them again and again. Thank you, Hannah.
Thank you, Shanti.
As one single drop of rain blesses the ocean, you too are a blessing in the ocean of boundless experience. Until we meet again, I am, as you are, here and now, the great mystery.